things that I'm hoping to convince you of today is first that there exist consistent ghost-free theories of massive gravity. And the second thing is that these theories of massive gravity are very intimately connected to theories of multiple interacting spin two fields. And in fact, what's remarkable about these theories of multiple interacting spin two fields is it turns out that they're a very straightforward generalization of structures that we already know for a long time existed in general relativity. So in fact, let me start by being explicit in what I mean by that. So let me start by considering, very simply, general relativity in four space-time dimensions. So you hear again and again that general relativity is the unique low-energy theory of a massless spin two field. So there are several different ways that you can arrive at this conclusion. One approach you can take is you can ask, so suppose I start with a theory, and I want to write down a Lagrangian that consists only of the metric tensor and its derivatives. So what are the terms that I can write down so that my equations of motion are guaranteed to be at most second order in derivatives? All right, so if you ask this question, what you arrive at are a series of terms known as Lovelock invariants. So to write down these Lovelock invariants in a compact way, let me introduce the one-form Veilbein, which I'm going to denote by E sub A, where this A is a Lorentz index. And in addition, let me introduce the two-form curvature tensor. RAB. So in four dimensions, these Lovelock invariants can be written in terms of wedge products of the Veilbein and of the curvature. So in particular, I have three different terms that I can write down. So I can write down a series of wedge products of the E's alone, where these E's are contracted with the flat space epsilon tensor. I can write down a term containing one curvature two form, contracted with two of the Veilbeins, again with Lorentz indices contracted with an epsilon tensor, and then a third term, which is just two curvature two forms. So of course, I know that this is just going to give me general relativity, and in fact, this term is equivalent to just a cosmological constant, determinant of G. This term here is just my Ricci scalar. And this third term here corresponds to the Gauss-Bonnet term, which in four dimensions is just a topological invariant, and so doesn't contribute to the equations of motion. All right, so the nice thing about writing usual general relativity in this form is that it's very easy then to generalize this to higher dimensions. So I can go to higher dimensions, and for simplicity, let me just consider even dimensional spacetimes. So let's look at 6D. And now I want to ask the same question. If I have a theory that's composed just of a metric, what are the terms that I can write down so that my equations of motion are at most second order in derivatives of the metric? And with this form, it's very straightforward to generalize to 6D. So what you find, so let me suppress the Lorentz indices, is I have terms now. I can wedge 6E's together. I can have an R wedged with 4E's. I have a 2R term, which now in six dimensions is no longer a topological invariant. And I have another term that wedges 3Rs together as well. So written in this way, it's straightforward then to see for higher dimensions, what are the terms that satisfy this condition. Now, the importance of not having higher derivatives in my equations of motion guarantees that I have the right number of propagating degrees of freedom. If I have higher derivative terms, I'm going to get more degrees of freedom than what I want for general relativity. And in particular, I'm going to get pathological degrees of freedom. I'm going to get ghosts. So by asking this question, what I'm really doing is I'm looking for ghost-free theories in higher dimensions. Okay, but what I'm interested in really for this talk is not necessarily the generalization of GR to higher dimensions. I'm interested in a different kind of generalization, which is the generalization from one spin two field to multiple spin two fields. So this is all, so if I have a number of spin two fields, this is all for say n equals one. And now instead of generalizing to higher dimensions, let me consider a generalization for n greater than 1, say. All right, and I should say, so this is work now that I'm doing with Kurt Hinterbinkler, who's at UPenn. So our claim is that if you want to write down, again, ghost-free theories of multiple interacting spin-2 fields, you can use this same Lovelock structure and generalize. So in particular, if I'm interested just in potential terms, so in non-derivative interactions, the generalization of this term to multiple spin-2 fields is going to look something like this. So let me introduce multiple metrics. So the G's indexed by I. So I can write them in terms of Wheelbinds, also indexed by I. So our claim is that the ghost-free interaction terms should look like this. EI1, wedge EI2, wedge EI3, wedge EI4. Yeah.
Can you apply formalism back to the wire all the time? I forget why it's called level of crack. You do write TR field binds, you have extra degrees of freedom. So historically, this is not important. Why is it called level of crack?
Oh, so it was David Lovelock who first set out these criteria. That if you want a theory, what should the equations of motion look like that must satisfy conditions such as symmetry, being divergence-free, and being at most second-order in derivatives of the metric. So in fact, the calling these specific terms with the wedge products of the Wheelbinds came later, but
no,
he was the one who...
Papers before Lovelock, Wheelbinds,
That's right.
It's a long history.
So our claim is that these are the ghost-free interactions of multiple spin-2 fields. All right, so let me look at a specific case. So let me consider a case, for example, where the number of spin-2 fields I'm interested in is equal to 2. So there are going to be 5 different terms that I can write down. So let me say that in addition to these interaction terms, I'm going to also introduce usual ghost-free potentials. Ghost-free kinetic terms for each of these spin-2 fields. So in addition to a sum over the usual Einstein-Hilbert terms, I'm going to add to my Lagrangian interaction terms of this kind. Yeah.
Could you write for mixed terms? So if you wedge your RAB with the corresponding field line, do you wedge it with the other field line, and would you get something else?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So we're not sure what the status of those terms are. We've been focusing just on the potential terms for now, but it's possible that those are ghost-free kinetic mixings as well. All right, so for n equals 2, I'm going to have the wedge product of 4 E1s, which is just going to be determinant of G1. I'm going to have a wedge product that includes 1 E2, one that includes 2 E2s, one that includes 3 E2s, and then I'm going to have the 4 E2 term. All right, so this term just corresponds to dead G2. Whereas these terms here constitute genuine interaction terms between my 2 spin-2 fields. So these, we claim, give you consistent ghost-free bimetric theories of gravity. So in the past year, there have been several developments along the direction of constructing ghost-free theories of massive gravity and ghost-free theories of bimetric gravity. But they've been formulated from a very different starting point. And one of the things that we're able to show is, in fact, these theories here, these interactions, are equivalent to the interactions that have been written down for these other bimetric theories. And in particular, if you want to write down a theory of, say, ghost-free massive gravity, all you need to do is you need to take one of the Wheelbinds in your theory and send the Planck mass to infinity, so essentially decouple it from the theory, and you're left with a theory of one massive spin-2 field. And the theory that you get in this way is entirely equivalent to the theories of ghost-free massive gravity that have been developed in the past couple of years. All right, so one of the nice things about this Fehrbein formulation then is that it enables you to go beyond ghost-free massive gravity and ghost-free bimetric gravity. So you can also consider a case where you say have three interacting spin two fields. So now this gives you terms of the following form. So you're going to have three terms, E2, E3, E1, E2, 3, and E1, E2, E3, and E3. So you can write down three different terms in which you have three spin two fields interacting at a given vertex. And we claim that these are also, we can show that these are also ghost-free interaction terms. And finally, you can have a theory with four interacting spin two fields at a given vertex. But one of the conclusions of this result is that, in fact, the number of spin two fields that you can have interacting at a given vertex appears to be limited by the number of space-time dimensions that you're in. You can't write down a theory of five spin twos interacting at a single vertex with each other. So that's one of the consequences. All right, so in fact, I've started with the conclusions of my talk, so let me go back to the beginning and describe the developments, most of them recent developments, that led us to this conclusion. It's not ghost free, so we get the you need Hamiltonian constraints, and the Hamiltonian constraints appear by the lapses appearing linearly in your Lagrangian. And if you square any of these terms, your lapses are no longer going to appear linearly. All right, so what led to this conclusion? Well, let me start with massive gravity. So what do I mean first by massive gravity? Let me consider fluctuations of the metric about some given background, g mu nu bar. And let's call these fluctuations h mu nu. So giving a mass term to the graviton corresponds to writing down in my Lagrangian terms that are quadratic in this term, in the fluctuation h, like so. So this is one of the most generic long-distance modifications of gravity that you can do. So by introducing a mass term for the graviton, you no longer have long-range interactions. You have interactions that are Yukawa-suppressed at large distances instead. So I say, conceptually, it's one of the most straightforward modifications, long-distance modifications of GR that you can do. In practice, it's turned out to be notoriously difficult to write down consistent theories in which the graviton has a mass. And one of the main reasons for this is the existence of a pathological degree of freedom called the Bulwer Desert Ghost. All right, so what is this ghost mode? How do I understand it? You can see its appearance just by looking at doing a simple accounting of degrees of freedom in massive gravity. So one way to do this is let me use the idiom formalism to count degrees of freedom. So I'm going to introduce a shift, which is g00 minus 1/2. Sorry, this is the lapse. This is the shift is ni, which is g0i. And let me denote by the spatial components of my metric a gamma ij. Like so. So in general relativity, when you write down the Hamiltonian in terms of these variables, what you find is the following. So the lapse and the shift, so there are, in four dimensions, there are four of these guys. They have no time derivatives. They appear with no time derivatives. And in addition, they appear linearly in the Lagrangian. And as a result of them appearing linearly in the Lagrangian, their equations of motion then acts as constraints. Yeah?
Sorry, I'm going back to that. But regarding the square, I mean, couldn't it's a thing that I will always give you a goal, because if I just say, when I don't say about massive gravity, I just think about gravity.
Yeah.
Certainly, I can write R squared and R cubed terms, and those will correspond to taking your R wedge E squaring.
You can add higher terms as long as they add up to total derivatives that don't contribute. But if you want them.
But if I massless GR, I can certainly add modifications like R squared, R cubed.
But then you do add extra degrees of freedom.
The equations become higher derivative generic.
No, you have the sort of terms from any kind of Lyapunov completion of gravity. You always have R squared, R cubed terms. Perfectly fine theory.
But that was the original motivation for writing down these Lovelock theory, these Lovelock terms, was seeing if you do go to higher dimensions, what are the higher terms that you can write down?
No, not so higher dimensions. So if you just have any kind of Lyapunov completion of gravity, you will have higher dimensional operators.
Which
like
generically
squared,
introduce extra degrees of freedom. You're going to have higher derivative equations of motion if you include these terms in your Lagrangian.
You usually treat that derivative.
That's right.
So you treat it derivative. So you're saying, you introduce a ghost, so you introduce it at the cutoff.
Yeah, that's,
that's right.
So you don't, but there's still a ghost, but it's at the cutoff.
So, well, whether or not there's a ghost is a question of what the
right,
precise
right.
Did that,
so, okay, so I can say, let me just say that I'm talking about classically ghost-free then. So classically, if you do what you're saying, you will introduce a ghost.
But I think the ghost will be at the cutoff, so I'm not sure why this is so important.
Actually, this is a question I wanted to ask. I mean, it's not been looked at whether quantum correction of this always push. I mean, the question is whether quantum correction will keep the form, or at least push it to the point where the ghost is at the cutoff.
So I think that the second part is true. So I think quantum corrections generically aren't going to preserve this form. But I think generically you can show that they will, that the ghost that they introduce is always going to only appear at the cutoff of your EFT.
You can show that.
Yeah. That's right. At least in massive gravity, that can be shown. And I think it's straightforward to generalize to these cases of multiple spin tunes.
Even the classical EFT, you have high order differential equations, it's called the Ostrogresky theorem. You can run into trouble with standard mechanics. Ostrogresky published this in 1899.
That's it.
So it's not even clear classical theory state.
Okay. So in fact,
there's a lot of trouble involved in what?
If you allow yourself to fine tune the initial condition, you're certainly stable.
Hello?
If you allow yourself to get rid of those modes in the initial condition, you're certainly stable.
You can't just get rid of
them. You tune them out in one additional condition, right? Those are exponentially growing modes that you can tune out.
That doesn't matter.
That's the actual.
Okay. So this is the standard picture in GR. The laps and shift appear linearly, which means that their equations of motion act as constraints on the remaining variables. The 6 gamma ij. These do appear with time derivatives, so these are dynamical variables, which means that there are 6 momenta canonically conjugate to these guys as well. So if I want to count total degrees of freedom, I have these 6 potentially propagating gamma ij and pi ij. However, I have 4 constraints. Coming from my laps and shift variables. And in addition, I have 4 general coordinate invariances of the theory, which I can use to eliminate an additional 4 degrees of freedom. So I'm left with 2 and 2, so a pair of propagating conjugate variables, which is what I expect for a massless spin 2 field. Okay, but what happens now when I go and I add a mass term like this to my Lagrangian? So the first thing that happens is generically, the laps and shift, even though they still appear with no time derivative, are not going to appear linearly in the Lagrangian anymore. And as a result, I'm not going to have these 4 constraints. And in addition, this term explicitly breaks my diffeomorphism invariance. So I don't have these 4 coordinate invariances. So instead of having 2 pairs of propagating degrees of freedom, I'm left with 6. Okay, but we know that in 4 dimensions, a massive graviton should only have 5 propagating degrees of freedom, corresponding to the 5 helicities. So you're left with 1 extra degree of freedom. And this degree of freedom, besides just being extra, is generically a ghost, a pathological degree of freedom. All right, so we want to try and get rid of this ghost mode. So let's ask, is it possible to introduce a mass term for the graviton in such a way that, that one constraint is maintained so that I can still eliminate this extra degree of freedom? So at the linear level, this has been known for a while, and the answer is yes. So this is 1939, the work of Fiertz and Pauli, who constructed a mass term that looked like so. So with a fixed coefficient between the two h mu nus, and with this particular choice of the coefficient, you can show that, that the Lagrangian is still linear in the lapse n. And therefore, I have 1 constraint on my dynamical variables. Now, I still need an additional constraint to eliminate the momentum that's canonically conjugate to that variable. And in fact, you can show that, that this constraint, so linear than m, so I have 1 Hamiltonian constraint. You can show that this constraint generates a secondary constraint. And I'll talk more about this later. To eliminate the canonically conjugate momentum. So at the linear level, this theory is ghost-free. Okay, but Fiertz and Pauli assumed a couple things. So first of all, they assumed that they were looking at fluctuations around flat space-time. And secondly, they assumed that these fluctuations were small. And in 1972, what Bouloir and Deser showed is that as soon as you try and go beyond the linear level, so either look at backgrounds that aren't flat, look at higher order terms in h mu nu, or equivalently let the little h's become large, the ghost reappears. So the ghost reappears at the nonlinear level. So in other words, your Lagrangian is always going to be nonlinear in both the lapse and shift variables at the nonlinear level. All right. So is there any way around this statement? The answer is yes. So it turns out that there's a caveat in the Bouloir-Deser argument. It goes something like this. All right, so let me look at the equations of motion of my Lagrangian with respect to the lapse and shift variables, because these are the equations where I would expect a constraint to come from. So let me suppose for a minute that if I look at the variation of the Lagrangian with respect to the lapse, I get some equation E, which depends on, I'm going to call it little ni, gamma, and pi, where now these little ni are a function of all 4 lapse and shift variables in addition to the gamma and pi variables. And let me suppose, so this is just suppose, that the same thing is true of the equations of motion with respect to the shift, that I can write it as some EI that's a function just of these little n variables, gamma and pi. So what happens in this situation is now I have 4 equations of motion, but they only depend on 3 ni. So in other words, only on 3 combinations of the lapse and shift variables. And as a result of that, I can say solve this equation here to get ni as a function of just the gamma and pi alone. And then plugging back in here, I see that the lapse equation of motion indeed becomes a constraint on the gamma and pi variables. So even though the original Lagrangian might be very nonlinear, in these laps and shifts, as long as the equations of motion depend only on three combinations of the laps and shift, I can still have a Hamiltonian constraint in the theory. So this equation becomes a Hamiltonian constraint. So this is the caveat in the Bulwer-Desert argument. And it turns out that theories that were written down in these past couple of years, first by Daram and Gabadazzi, and then by Daram, Gabadazzi, and Tolle, succeed in realizing this setup. Although it should be said that these theories were arrived at from very different considerations. So they looked for theories that were ghost-free in a certain high energy limit called the decoupling limit. And so they were able to, let me do this here. So this is Daram Gabadazzi, this is 2010, and then Daram Gabadazzi and Tolle, which was also 2010. So they were able to write down a nonlinear theory of massive gravity that was ghost-free in the decoupling limit. All right, so this theory looks like this. I'm going to use a slightly different formulation than the one they originally proposed, but it's completely equivalent. All right, so I have the usual Einstein-Hilbert kinetic term. And then in addition, I introduce a potential, which has five free coefficients. So n goes from 0 to 4. And it's a function of elementary symmetric polynomials of a matrix I'm going to call G inverse F. So F here is a non-dynamical auxiliary metric. This square root is defined so that root G inverse F, root G inverse F is equal to G mu lambda F lambda nu. And these elementary symmetric polynomials are given by the following. So if I consider, say, S0 of a generic matrix X, this is 0, S1 of X is equal to the trace of X. So I'm going to use square brackets to denote trace. S2 of X is 1 half trace of X squared minus trace X squared. S3 of X is 1 sixth. It's going to be X cubed minus 3X X squared plus 2X cubed. And in fact, in four dimensions, so S4 of X is going to be just the determinant of X. And in D equals 4, this sum stops, or sorry, this series stops at four terms. All right, so in fact, these elementary symmetric polynomials also have a nice formulation in terms of the eigenvalues of this matrix X. So if I want to write them in terms of, say, lambda of X, so S1 is just going to be the sum of all the eigenvalues. S2 is going to be the sum of all set pairs of two eigenvalues, so lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 1, lambda 3, lambda 1, lambda 4, etc. S3 is going to be the sum of all sets of three eigenvalues, so I say I less than j less than k. And then, of course, S4 is just going to be the product of all four eigenvalues. So in this formulation, it makes sense why this series stops at the same number of space-time dimensions. All right, so these are the potentially ghost-free actions that they proposed. And what I was able to show with Fawad Hassan, who's at Stockholm University, is that, in fact, away from the decoupling limit as well, these actions satisfy this caveat in the Bolwar-Desert argument, so that you get a Hamiltonian constraint from these actions. Yeah, so they took F to be eta originally because they wanted to consider massive gravity around a flat background. But the point is that once you fix it in your theory, it's fixed for all time in this formulation. But in fact, one of the things that I'm going to talk about is how to promote this F to a dynamical variable, so that in fact you can have a theory of two interacting spin two fields. Yeah. That's right. So these theories generically exhibit a Weinstein mechanism. So at short distances, depending on the coefficients that you put here, but for fairly generic coefficients, you can recover general relativity at short distances.
So it's not receptive to that.
That's right.
Is that why?
That it's non-perturbative?
Yeah. How rigorous is this?
I think it's fairly rigorous. So people have done it numerically. And in fact, there was a paper recently by Gabadazzi and Hinterbinkler that talked about having sort of a dual formulation of these theories inside the Weinstein radius, in which you could use a perturbative calculation to recover this result. So they are able to find self-accelerating solutions in these theories.
So they have to be removed.
Why do they have to be removed?
Well, what's the original problem with self-accelerating
As far as I know, these have healthy self-accelerating solutions. Okay, so this was work done with Fawad Hassan at Stockholm University. And what we were able to show is that, so let me, in addition to introducing ADM variables for my dynamical metric G, let me also, for simplicity, introduce ADM variables for F as well. And I'm going to call these M and MI instead of N and NI. So if you perform the following redefinition, so NI minus MI is equal to m delta ij plus n dij times some little nj, where the matrix D is given by 1 minus nf, and D is equal to square root gamma minus dn dnf. So here I'm writing in matrix form and suppressing indices. So this is D as a function of n and these other variables. D is this matrix here, which is given by the solution to this equation. So you can solve this explicitly, but it's more compact to write it in this form. So if I use this expression to replace the shift in my Lagrangian in favor of the little nj variables, what I find is the following. So I can write L, now in ADM variables, as pi ij, gamma ij dot minus some h naught, which is a function of little n, gamma n pi, plus the lapse n times some function c, which is a function only of the little n, gamma n pi as well. So this is what I get after this replacement. So now, in fact, in terms of these variables, my Lagrangian is manifestly linear in the lapse n. However, that's not enough, so I need to look at what's going on with the little n equations of motion. So let me consider dl dn. And what I find when I do this is that I can write my equation of motion as, say, some ci, which depends only on little n gamma and pi, times delta nk, and then basically this expression here. So m delta ij plus n dij nj. So this is my little n equation of motion. And what you see is that even though this equation of motion does depend on the lapse variable, this whole term here, in fact, is just the Jacobian of the transformation, right? And this transformation is invertible. And so this term here in the square brackets is never zero. So in fact, my true equations of motion are just that ci of n gamma and pi is equal to zero. Now, this equation of motion is independent of the lapse n, which means that I can solve for little n as a function of gamma and pi alone. So now let me return to the Lagrangian. If I vary with respect to the lapse n, I find dl dn just gives me c, which is a function of n gamma and pi, which is equal to 0. If I use this expression here to rewrite n in terms of gamma and pi, I find that, in fact, I have a Hamiltonian constraint on my dynamical variables. All right, so that's great. So the Hamiltonian constraint is going to remove the degree of freedom in this gamma associated with the ghost modes. So out of six initial gammas, I'm only going to have five left. However, I still need to remove the momentum that's canonically conjugate to this variable, right? All right, so in order to do that, I'm going to look at the secondary constraint generated by this theory. Yes. So one way that you can see this, I should say not necessarily. You can still have theories of massive gravity with five propagating degrees of freedom where one of them is ghost-like. So an example of this is if you go to De Sitter space and you violate the Higuchi bound, you're going to have instabilities in that theory. So it doesn't guarantee that the remaining 5 degrees of freedom are healthy. It just guarantees that you only have 5 degrees of freedom. Well, what do you mean by the right degree of freedom?
Well, the ones that the ghost like degree of freedom.
Well, you're removing a degree of freedom.
I know. But
so you're left with a theory of 5 degrees of freedom.
Right.
This can't guarantee that all five of those are healthy degrees of freedom.
But I'm saying, are there particular instances
Oh, yeah, no, so there. If you do look at this theory and you expand, say, around flat space-time, all five of those degrees of freedom are going to be healthy degrees of freedom. All right, so what is the secondary constraint that I'm talking about? Well, a consistency condition on this theory is that not only that if I have this Hamiltonian constraint, it should hold not just at one instance in time, but it should hold for all times as well. So in other words, in order for my theory to be consistent, I must have that ddt of this Hamiltonian constraint is 0. Right. But I can write this in terms of a Poisson bracket formulation. So in other words, this is telling me that c of x Poisson bracket with the Hamiltonian should be equal to 0, where here the Hamiltonian is defined as d cubed y, and then this guy right here, so h naught minus nc, like so. So I want to impose this condition. Now, two things can happen when I impose this condition. So one thing that can happen is that I can find that the Poisson bracket of the constraint with itself is not equal to 0. So if that happens, then this consistency condition is going to depend on the lapse function n, right? Because the term involving the Poisson bracket of the constraint with itself is not going to drop out. So because my consistency condition depends on n, so let me call this star. So star depends on n, then my consistency condition, in fact, becomes an equation for the lapse n. So I can use this equation to solve for n. But then this equation is not acting as a constraint on the dynamical variables, and it's not working to remove this extra degree of freedom. So in this case, in a sense, I've only removed half of a degree of freedom, and my theory still has half of a Bolivar desert ghost hanging around. Okay, so then this becomes an equation for n, and then there's no secondary constraint. However, alternatively, I could find, when I plug in these values here, that in fact, the commutator, or the Poisson bracket of the constraint with itself, does vanish on the constraint surface. And in that case, my consistency condition is going to be independent of the lapse n. What I'm going to find instead is that my consistency condition can be written just as the commutator of C and H naught equal to zero. So this is going to be independent of the lapse and shift variables, and therefore this consistency condition becomes a secondary constraint on the dynamical variables. All right. So in fact, we went ahead and we calculated this. Let me move this up. So what you find when you calculate the commutator of the Hamiltonian constraint with itself is you get something that looks like C of x dxi acting on delta x minus y, and then minus the same thing with x replaced by y, like so. So what you see is that on the constraint surface, so in other words, when the constraint is satisfied, when C is equal to zero, the right-hand side vanishes here. So on the constraint surface, I have that C of x with itself is equal to zero. So in fact, I am in the second situation described here. By imposing this consistency constraint, I end up with a secondary constraint on these dynamical variables. So because of this, I can remove the momentum that's canonically conjugate to the ghost field, and then therefore these theories of massive gravity are entirely free of the Bolivar desert ghost. All right, that's great. So now I have ghost-free theories of massive gravity. One of the things that was asked before is what is the situation with this extra metric, f? Is this something that's chosen by hand? Do you accept that if this is your theory of massive gravity, that the universe comes with some fixed reference metric? What's the story? So one of the things that you can do to make this more natural is try and promote this extra auxiliary metric to be a dynamical field in and of itself. But you want to do it in such a way that you maintain the consistency of the theory. You don't want to reintroduce the Bolivar desert ghost by introducing the wrong kinetic term for this f mu nu. So let's do first a naive counting of degrees of freedom. So let's see. So I erased those actions. But schematically, let me write. OK, so we had s was equal to Planck squared d for x r plus 2m squared, sum over beta n, sn of root g inverse f, like so. All right, so by making f a dynamical variable, first of all, I restore general coordinate invariance to my theory. So I can now rotate both g and f simultaneously so that I have one overall general coordinate invariance. All right, but I have two fully dynamical metrics now. And what we saw before is that each metric contains potentially 6 propagating modes. So I can use my general coordinate invariance to remove 4 of these modes in the same way that I could for GR. But what I'm left with then is 8 potentially propagating modes, right? So one massless field and one massive field, but still potentially with this extra Boulevard-Desert ghost problem. All right, so the question is, what is the kinetic term for F that we can introduce that maintains this Hamiltonian constraint? All right, so in order to find that, it's helpful first to recast this potential term as a potential for F rather than for G. I'm sorry, these all should have a root at G in front of all of them. All right, so the first thing I can do is I can just rewrite root dot g as root dot f times det of g inverse f, like so, square root, like so. All right, so in other words, using these symmetric polynomials over here, this is equal to root dot f times s4 of root g inverse f. All right, but what about the symmetric polynomials themselves? So one thing I can do is I can try and recast the original symmetric polynomials as symmetric polynomials of the inverse matrix, so of f inverse g, rather than g inverse f. So what you find is the following. So s0 of x inverse, still going to be 0. S1 of x inverse now is going to be 1 over lambda 1 plus 1 over lambda 2 plus 1 over lambda 3 plus 1 over lambda 4. S2 of x inverse is going to be 1 over the product of all 2 eigenvalues and so forth. So now these eigenvalues are the original eigenvalues of the matrix X. But just by comparing these two sets, I see that, in fact, I can rewrite the Sn of x as equal to S of 4 minus n x inverse divided by S4 of x. Which means that if I take this expression here, written now in terms of f and the symmetric polynomials of the inverse matrix, I can write g inverse sn of root g inverse f as equal to root f s4 minus n of root f inverse. So in fact, what we showed before is that when f is non-dynamical, this is the correct ghost-free potential for g. But now, because we have this equivalent formulation, we can also argue that when g is non-dynamical, this has the correct ghost-free form for f, if I just include the usual Einstein-Hilbert kinetic term for my f as well. Actually, I want to keep. Okay, so my proposed bimetric gravity is going to look something like this. So I'm going to have, let's call it mg squared d4x root g r g plus mf squared. So I'm introducing different Planck masses for the g and f sector. Rf, like so. And now I'm going to have the term that mixes the two. So this is going to be 2m squared. And let me define some m effective squared. Integral d4x root g beta n sn of root g inverse f, like so. OK, so again, like I said, this result implies that when F is non-dynamical, G, the G sector is ghost-free, and similarly, when G is non-dynamical, the F sector is ghost-free, but it's not obvious how this eliminates the ghost when both sectors are dynamical at the same time. So to see this, let's again do an ADM analysis, and I'll just give you the summary since I'm running short of time. But if I perform the same, if I do the same change of variables that I did before, sorry, let me now be explicit. So again, I have a lapse in shift for my original metric G. In addition, I have the 6 gamma ij and the 6 pi ij. In addition, I now have lapse and shift for the F sector. I have 6 fij and 6, let's call them pij, the momentum canonically conjugate to the F. So altogether, I have 24 potentially propagating modes. Okay, now I do the same change of variables that I did before. So I do this. This ni minus mi is equal to this function m delta ij minus n dij nj. And I use this expression to replace ni in favor of little ni in the Lagrangian. And what I find is the following. So I have the same Hamiltonian constraint. That I did previously. This generates a secondary constraint. But in addition, once I've written my Lagrangian in terms of these variables, I find that the Lagrangian is now linear in the lapse and shift of the F variables. So in other words, these guys now generate an additional 4 constraints. On top of which, by making F dynamical, I restored the general coordinate invariance of my theory. So I have an additional 4 general coordinate invariances. All right, so let me count degrees of freedom. So I start with 24 potentially propagating modes. I have minus 1 Hamiltonian constraint, minus 1 associated secondary constraint, minus 4 constraints coming from the lapse and shift of the F sector, and then minus 4 variables I can eliminate via my general coordinate invariance. So I'm left with 14 phase space variables, so 7 total propagating modes. So this is 2 plus 5. This is the right number of degrees of freedom for a theory of one massless spin 2 field interacting with one massive spin 2 field. So the theory remains ghost-free even when F is dynamical. Okay, but now do I have a few minutes left? Okay. So let me come back around to what I was talking about in the beginning. Suppose now that I want to generalize the structure. I have a consistent theory of two interacting spin 2 fields. I want to know what is the consistent theory of multiple interacting spin 2 fields. Now it turns out what Kurt and I were able to show is that these elementary symmetric polynomials, as soon as I write them with the root g's, the appropriate root g's in front, so now again, x is equal to root g inverse f here. These are equivalent to theories I was describing earlier formulated in terms of the Feuerbinds. So let me write my metric G as some E1 eta E1 transpose and F as E2 eta E2 transpose. So what we can show is that, I'm sorry, this isn't 0, this is 1. I did it again over here. All right, so what we can show is that these interaction terms are equivalent to a theory with interaction terms written in terms of the Feuerbein in the following way. So this S1 is equivalent to E1, wedge E1, wedge E1, wedge E2. This S2 is E1, wedge E1, wedge E2, wedge E2. And this E3 is E1, and then three E2s. And then, of course, the 0 and the 4 component are just the ones with all 4. Like so. All right, so one of the advantages of writing in terms of the Feuerbein formulation is that you find when you do that, so you are introducing extra components when you introduce the Feuerbein. So each metric has 10 components in 4 dimensions, whereas each Feuerbein has 16. So you have to keep track of the number of components. But in fact, it turns out that the number of counting of degrees of freedom is much more straightforward in the Feuerbein formulation, that when you write your potential terms in this form, it follows automatically that your Lagrangian is linear in the lapses and shifts of all of the variables that you can introduce. And so you can then just do a very straightforward counting of constraints and number of variables to arrive at the same conclusion of Ghost Freedom without having to do that kind of crazy redefinition that I introduced before. So one advantage that you get of the Feuerbein formulation is a simpler analysis of the ghost problem. But the other advantage is that it allows you to generalize these theories beyond theories of two interacting spin two fields. So as we were talking about before, every time you introduce a new spin two field in your theory, you're introducing 6 potentially propagating degrees of freedom, but you still only have 1 overall diff invariance. You're not introducing an additional diff invariance every time you introduce a spin two. So every time you introduce a spin two, it needs to come with a Hamiltonian constraint in order to give you the right number of degrees of freedom. And what we're able to show is that these generalized theories, so say E1, E2, well, let me call it EI1, EI2, EI3, and EI4, automatically give you that structure. That forever how many spin two fields you have, so suppose you have n spin two fields, you find that you have the right number of degrees of freedom for n minus 1 massive spin twos and 1 massless spin two, and no extra pathological degrees of freedom as well. So I should say that given just the bimetric theory, it's straightforward to construct theories of multiple interacting spin two fields in somewhat a trivial way just by connecting pairs of spin two fields. So for example, if I have some G1, G2, G3, G4, I can connect all of these pairwise just by using the terms of the bimetric theory. But what's novel about these terms here is that it's really multiple spin two fields acting at a single vertex. So for example, what this term would allow you to do would be to connect all 4 terms like this. So this is the new structure. All right, and so since I started with my conclusions, I'll end here. Thank you.
Questions?
Is there a way, the question I asked before, is there a way to see that the form of these polynomials is preserved under kind of correction? And I guess it looks easier to show when you write it in terms of Feuerbein. You're saying that if you start with a bunch of terms which are just wedge product Feuerbein, you're not going to generate something that cannot be expressed this way?
I think they're not preserved generally under quantum corrections. In fact, I don't expect them to be preserved under quantum corrections.
But then if they're not, this would not be something, these terms are potential terms. They're not going to be like scribe. I mean, you would be introduced a ghost then, and then below the cutoff.
It shouldn't, the ghost that you introduced this way should be at the cutoff of the theory.
How do you see this?
Let's see. So, I mean, I can consider the case of massive gravity for one. So to get massive gravity, I can just, for one of these, say for E2, I can just stick in the unit matrix. And then we know just, I mean, I think just by usual effective field theory arguments, that the mass of the ghost that's introduced this way is always going to be at the I'm not answering your question in detail, but yeah. let me think about it. But I mean, I should say that I know that it's been shown for the massive gravity theory that this is the case. But I need to think more carefully about it to answer your question.
Because it looks like a potential, not like a higher derivative.
Oh, well, you can understand it in terms of higher derivative terms. So if you do like a helicity decomposition for the metric, then you have, if you look at the longitudinal component, then those are the higher derivative terms that are suppressed by the scale of your EFT. So you have like, if the longitudinal component of your metric is say phi, then you have higher powers of d phi suppressed by this lambda 3 scale. So where this lambda 3 is this m squared m plane to the 1/3, where this is the graviton mass. So if you do an analysis of these terms, you find that the higher derivative terms that you introduced are still suppressed by this lambda 3.
So I think one hand-waving way of arguing that is that the dangerous terms are non-normalizable terms of the form box phi cube. Right, that's the kind of term that you're harmful there. And if you have some loop correction that corrects that, power counting that should go like 1/100.
But the point is that this I think is 2. There's no cutoff anywhere. I'm just saying that thickness two is the one half minus a half. Now I see one becomes one half minus two.
Right.
Two, but there's no, where's the cutoff?
So that's where this decoupling limit is actually helpful. The dangerous parts are really the longitudinal pieces, and they scale differently with some energies and transverse points.
Yeah.
In the field theory, gauging various guarantees that you decouple all the physical modes. For example, if you put in a photon mass per hand, you get a physical modes. So what you do is you introduce a new degree of freedom, scalar fields, to a stupid ground to get a new gauging rate.
Mm-hmm.
Union theories is fine. People want to normalize. Another theory is it's not trivial. So another theory of base theory is like gravity. You couple the gravity laws. And so there, in the Valley Capitacci variety of stuff, how do they reintroduce that gauging theories? How do you guarantee it? See, that's where you really understand what's going on.
Sorry, you're asking how do I guarantee gauge invariance,
yeah.
General coordinate invariance?
You violated, put in the mass of the graviton by hand.
Yeah.
You violated gauge invariance.
That's right. So in the theory just of massive gravity, you have violated gauge invariance, but you can do the same Stueckelberg trick. You can introduce 4 scalar fields with transformation properties that restore the general coordinate invariance. And in fact, it was in this setup that these theories of massive gravity were initially studied.
It doesn't lead to the normalizable theory.
No, it's still a non-renormalizable theory.
Even spontaneous symmetry theory, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But why are you putting so much effort into getting massive gravity?
Well,
what do I get from it?
You get a consistent infrared deviation from general relativity.
So what?
So the original motivations for studying these theories are things like dark matter, dark energy, and the cosmological constant problem. That you can say maybe, dark energy doesn't exist, dark matter doesn't exist. It's just that our understanding of GR is not consistent at large distances. How can I modify general relativity at large distances to explain these problems? And I think right away what people ran into is it turns out that it's very hard to consistently modify general relativity at large distances, independent of solving these problems. So some of the motivation for doing this is it even theoretically possible to write down a mass for the graviton?
And it doesn't solve the cosmological constant.
No, but it has potential. So there are these theories of degravitation, which are ways in which the essence is that gravity becomes less sensitive to a cosmological constant at large distance. And one way to realize these theories are in the framework of massive gravity. And in fact, there are cosmological solutions to these theories that do that. But unfortunately, the perturbations in these theories don't match up with observation. But some of these degravitation type scenarios can be realized in these theories.
It's possible you've replaced one set of problems by another.
I guess if my initial problem was just, is there a consistent theory of massive gravity, then I would consider that problem solved.
So in your case with both G and F are dynamical, you say you have a Hamiltonian from F, the left function of F, and a secondary constraint is also a Hamiltonian. I'm confused why you have two Hamiltonians in the system. How do F evolve time evolution? What's the bracket with Hamiltonian? Which one do you use?
There's only one Hamiltonian of the system.
Right. So one is the left, when you vary the left function, vary N. The other one is the secondary.
Sorry, I think I'm not understanding your question. So the original constraint, maybe it's up here.
So when you make the F dynamical,
yeah.
You say you restore the general covariance, so you vary the left function of N,
mm-hmm.
Get the Hamiltonian constraint.
When I vary with respect to, after doing this redefinition, when I vary with respect to N, I get what's called the Hamiltonian constraint.
That's the Hamiltonian, the total system. It's not the secondary constraint derived before. Before that, you set F to be background and you derive a secondary constraint. You say that's Hamiltonian.
I called it the
Hamiltonian constraint.
Hamiltonian constraint. It's not the Hamiltonian. The constraint is not equal to the Hamiltonian.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's also.
Yeah.
So have you, or has anybody else looked at what kind of constraints are placed on these theories from, say, binary pulsar timing or precision measurements in the solar system like this?
That's a very interesting question. So I know that, so there was a bimetric theory by Nathan Rosen many years ago that in fact was ruled out by these kinds of considerations. But I think nobody has applied the same kind of reasoning to these new bimetric theories at all. One thing that comes into play is that, so you do have this Weinstein mechanism in which you recover general relativity at short distances. And so it's basically for some massive object, M, is going to have a Weinstein radius, fairly large, that goes like, so R Weinstein goes like the mass over M Planck, I think to the 1/3, times 1 over the cutoff of the theory. So this is quite a large radius. And within this radius is where you expect general relativity to be recovered. So if you're just looking at something like massive gravity, you wouldn't expect to see too many deviations from GR just because your entire system would be inside its own Weinstein radius. But I think for say, multimetric gravity, it becomes more interesting.
So you're imagining there are different kinds of matter that couple to these to make F dynamical, that different flavors of matter that couples these two different methods?
You could do that. I think the most straightforward thing you can do without, say, violating equivalence principle or other constraints such like that is just pick one of the metrics and couple matter to that metric alone, and then leave the, say, the F not coupled. But it's not obvious if you do, say, couple both metrics to the same matter sector or both metrics to different matter sectors. How strong are the constraints that you run into?
I would think pretty strong because I couple both. Well, the pulsars generally expect to radiate at least twice as fast, which we now have two gravitons.
So if you do have two gravitons, then you would have to change the Planck masses for both theories, right? So if both of them couple to matter, then if you just, I mean, at least at the linear level, if you cut the Planck mass in half, you would expect to see the same thing. Because at linear level, having two gravitons coupled with the same matter is like having one graviton but with twice the Planck mass.
Sure.
So I'm saying something very, yeah. So in order for a binary pulsar to, say, radiate twice as much stuff, you would want to be coupling G1 and G2 to the same matter sectors. So I'd have a root G1 and a root G2 coupled to the same matter sectors. But at the linear level, this is just going to be G1 mu nu T mu nu and G2 mu nu T mu nu, right? So depending on what the Planck masses are, I can tune the Planck mass so that I can just call whatever appears in front of T mu nu, this sum of the two, some new G tilde mu nu with the appropriate Planck mass in front.
The first
so this is
biometric theory was
by
Nathan Rosen, presumably is not wasn't related to me.
No.
And 1936. It's taken up a pattern picture of Clinton. And Einstein didn't like it anyway. It doesn't work. It's a disequation by the pulse PSI 1936. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work with solar system. So this is a good question. How do we know this fits the data?
Yeah, so I think because...
I have to answer that.
Exactly. So we have this...
I have a small question. In the last action you wrote, was the role of G and F are the same thing because of the constraint that you just erased when you changed the role of F and G? How do you know which field is the massive and which one is the massive? You choose one.
No, so in fact, if you look at the mass eigenstates, they're combinations of both F and G. So you have to diagonalize if you want to, right? Yeah. If in the limit that you take one of the Planck masses to infinity, then it's the field with the large Planck mass that gets associated with the massless field, and the dynamical field is the massive field. But unless you're in a limit where one Planck mass is much larger than the other, it's a combination of both G and F.
So you want to measure distance, how do you do that? You pick one?
Well, you can measure distance with the metric that couples to matter, but it's just this is not the, you can't call this the massive spin 2 or the massless spin 2 field.
What is the typical scale of the Einstein radius, like for, I don't know, the solar mass?
So I it's quite large. I think it's something, for a solar mass, it's something like 10 to the 16 kilometers. So well outside solar system. So in fact, this is how you avoid solar system constraints on massive gravity theory.
Any other questions? Oh,